experience, which how often do you get to go to morgues in high school? Hopefully never. So what we're going to do today and tomorrow is talk about scenarios, and then next week do them. So the way I think it's most interesting to learn is that I'll tell you stories, real stories that happened in the hospital, obviously changing very minor details just so that to protect anonymity, and let's debate what do you think is the right thing to do. The point is, these are stories that it might not be obvious what's right to do. That's in like medical ethics, we often say we're trying to choose the least bad option. There's not usually like a clear right or wrong. You can see people making lots of different decisions. We want to try to pick the least bad, the best decision possible in difficult circumstances. I'll share with you a few stories, depending on how much time we have to get through them. We'll debate them, what we think's right, and then we'll do that as well tomorrow, and we'll start looking at some of the actual biology behind what we're talking about, and also halakhic sources, and then we'll actually go do them, practice these procedures. So, case number one. This happened maybe 7 or 8 years ago. We had a patient, actually, it's relevant because he was not much older than all of you. He went to Yeshiva Day School on the East Coast and graduated high school. Any of you going to Israel next year? Yeah, a lot of you? Oh, it looks like almost everyone. Good. So that is what we often expect or hope from any Yeshiva Day School graduates. He went to day school on the East Coast, and then instead of going further east to Israel, he actually came here to LA, to Hollywood, not too far from this school, right? Not Hollywood, our neighborhood, but you know, like Hollywood, like Sunset, Hollywood Boulevard. And he didn't go necessarily for the best Jewish reasons. In fact, he came here and didn't even tell his parents he was coming here. He left here, never wanted to speak to them again. The reason I know that is because he ended up in our emergency room. He had a very Jewish name, even though you couldn't necessarily tell he was Jewish. But looking at him at this point, this was 2 years after moving to LA. At this point, he already had lots of piercings and tattoos and had been on lots of drugs. But he had a very Jewish name. This isn't his name. Let's say it's something like, you know, Yechiel Goldstein, something like that. Like you can fake. So the social worker is trying to meet him. He's in the emergency room, very not sober, very sick. And it's important for doctors to know about their patients a little bit, like if they're allergic to something or what their medical history is or why they're here in the hospital. You know, imagine someone comes to the emergency room, they're very sick, they're throwing up, they look horrible, but you don't have no idea why they're here. You don't know if they are on cancer treatment. You don't know what's going on with them. So the doctors are trying to get to know him. What happened to you? Why are you here? And he's just like fighting with them, just being aggressive. And the social worker's job is to find out, what is your name? Where are you from? Tell us about yourself. Do you have someone, family, that could help you? Do you have somewhere to go if you get discharged? And he's not sharing with her anything. And she had the idea, maybe the rabbi could get through to him. Do you mind closing the door? Thanks. Maybe the rabbi could get through to him because he has such a Jewish name. He's clearly Jewish, so maybe he'll have better luck than I have. So I met him. I also found him to be very combative and difficult. The things he told me, and every detail is important, so remember, things he told me are, as I said, he hates his parents. He never wants to speak to them again. They don't know where he is, and he doesn't care. And that's about all I got. And basically we started to find out that he was drinking a lot. I told you he wasn't sober. It was mostly from alcohol. He drank a lot of alcohol. He was 20 years old. He drank so much alcohol that he already had signs of liver failure at 20 years old. So I figured, you know, okay, I got at least to know him a little bit. We've got some rapport. I did get the neighborhood that he's from, the shul that he goes to, and also the school that he had gone to. And I figured, you know, tomorrow I'll try. I'm not going to get to know so much about him. I can't push so much. He's clearly not so easy to get along with. Tomorrow I'll get to know him better. The next day I came back and they told me he's doing much worse. And in fact, he's not even conscious. And they said, Rabbi, did you get some information? Like, can you help us find his family? Because we need to know details about who he is and where he's from and his medical history. Are you able to tell us and help us track down his parents? Now, you all know. Do you think if I know someone's name, the shul they grew up in, and the yeshiva day school that they went to, would I be able to track down their family? Yeah. Easy, right? I could just call the school or the rabbi at the shul, tell him, here's the name, where's the parents? So, but should I? Meaning, what do I know about him? He doesn't want to talk to his parents. So now the doctor is saying to me, Rabbi, you're the one that knows who, how to get, reach his family. Help us call the family. Should I comply? Should I call the family?
Well, his life is more important than
okay. His life's more important. You said
he still doesn't have to talk to them. You could just get the information you need.
Right. You just get the medical information.
In their court. They can come if they want.
Right. Okay. Good. Any other opinions? Anyone say no? Don't call them. It's not right. He wouldn't want it.
Like if he woke up and he found out that his parents were on his way, like
right.
he might just fight it even more, and like now he'd be like completely in compliance. Like he's like, I don't want to listen to anyone because you went against what he said, which
right.
is don't call my parents.
Right. And he's an adult. He's 20 years old. Right, so this is the dilemma. Like, also, everything as a chaplain, as a rabbi in the hospital, any employee in the hospital, everything's super confidential. So now I'm supposed to, and I'm trying to build rapport with him. Right, I'm trying to, like, I realize he's not easy to talk to, and I'm trying to build a relationship, and I see that now I have a dilemma. Like, do I break my trust with him? But as you pointed out, your initial reaction, our risk management department, the lawyers in the hospital, imagine. I don't know what you all want to do professionally, but being lawyers in the hospital is actually a very important role. They're very busy in the hospital, and they said to me, this could be just, you should call the family, because this is life and death. We need this information. The doctors need it. You're not giving them, you're not even telling them protected health information about him, but they're going to know something. They're going to know that he's in the hospital. They're going to know where he is. They didn't even know what state he's in. So I tracked down the parents very quickly. It's very easy, as you can imagine. And they were extremely excited to find out where he is. So much so that they actually said to me, we're coming right now. We're going to the airport. We're going to buy our tickets in the car on the way to the airport. We're going to come immediately. And they did give us information about him. Not that much. It turned out the whole issue was just that he drank so much. In the 2 years that he'd been in L.A., he was drinking so much very hard liquor that just put him into liver failure. The parents came right away. They were literally there that night. They came so quickly. But he wasn't alert. And they were by the bedside waiting. Here comes the real challenging question that I want to hear your opinions about. It took a couple days of him not waking up and his condition declining before the doctors, first they were saying it's liver failure. They were talking about maybe a liver transplant. Then they were saying end-stage liver failure, like it's not recoverable. Then they were saying multi-system organ failure, like all of his organs were shutting down. And what turned out was that actually he was dying because of alcohol poisoning. Like he clearly drank a lot, or maybe did other things, we're not totally sure, but he was dying from what he did. Really scary, tragic story. But here's the question. The parents immediately said, okay, well, we're here. Like we want to be able to talk to him. At this point, they had intubated him. They put in an endotracheal tube in his throat. This is what we're going to do next week. One of you is going to volunteer. We're going to intubate one of you. Anyone volunteer right now? Yeah, you'll do it?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Your mom actually was a nurse at Cedars.
Yeah.
So maybe, I'm joking. We're not going to intubate you, though.
Aww.
We're not really going to do it. Well, you'll find out why you don't want that. Especially if you're awake.
Yeah, I was thinking about it.
You're like, what did I just volunteer for? No, but we are going to intubate. We're going to have a chance to intubate, but not each other. So he was intubated. What happened was he was constantly pulling it out. he wasn't alert when he was intubated, but then he would wake up. He would have periods of being alert. When he would be alert, he would pull it out. And that's obviously very dangerous. You can imagine why someone wouldn't want a tube down their throat going into their lungs. But you can also imagine why it's not good to then yank it out, constantly. You can imagine how bad that is for your trachea and your lungs and your throat. So they had to sedate him. So that's why he was sedated when the parents came, was to keep, because he needed the tube in his throat to keep him breathing, because otherwise his body was shutting down. So the parents said, can we talk to him? We want to tell him we love him. We don't know what he thinks of us. Like, he ran away from home. We want to tell him we love him. We want to apologize if we did anything wrong to him. Maybe he wants to apologize to us. Like, can't we talk to him? So the doctor said, well, here's the thing. At this point, now this is a few days later, at this point, his body's shutting down. He's actually in a dying process. So they said, if we wake him up, we have to take the tube out because he's going to yank it out anyways. So we have to first take the tube out and then wake him up. The problem is, if we do that, he's going to die within a couple of days. Like, he can't survive on his own. So he will take it out. Yes, he'll wake up, but then he'll be dead in a couple of days. They said, well, what if you leave it in? So if you leave it in, he's also going to die, but it will be gradual, slow death. It'll take about maybe 3 months, but he'll never wake up. So their question was, and then they turned to me, Rabbi. They're a very religious family. Well, what does halacha say? Can we pull the plug, so to speak, remove the endotracheal tube, extubate, to wake him up in order to interact with him and talk to him? Or do we just do nothing, but then he also dies, but slower, and we're not hastening his death, but then we never get to talk to him again? And then again, we don't know how he's going to react when he sees them. As you all pointed out, he might be very upset. What do you think is the right thing to do? Yes?
I have a question. Why can't you put in the tube after he talks to them again? Because you're
good.
Saying you're putting it in and out.
Or yes, whatever. Very good. That came up. That, what'd you say?
I think taking it out and letting him talk to his parents, or at least letting him live for another 3 days, is better than just letting him die.
Uh-huh.
Well, he basically already dead.
Okay, so you say wake him up. Sorry, your name again?
Leah.
You brought up a good point about this is an interesting compromise. It's like you say, wake him up. Some people are going to say, anyone say, no, how could you wake him up? You're making him die sooner. Anyone say that? What do you say?
Because isn't it halacha that you can't, you have to extend even like 1 second of someone's life if you could?
Right, well, we'll talk about that. But do you have to extend life? Or for sure, is there a prohibition against making someone die faster? So many people will say, yeah, it's sad, but how could you make him die faster? If you're asking a halachic question, you have to allow him to die, but you can't cause him to die faster. You can't hasten his death. So here we have one person who said, wake him up, give him the chance to see his family. Another person who said, but halachically, how can you make him die faster? And then a compromise could be, well, wake him up, let him talk, and then put him back on the tube, put him back on the respirator. And we did bring up that possibility. It could be that if we would have pushed more, we could have done that. But the resident who we were speaking to who gave us that option just said, like, we have to decide one way or the other. We're not, that's like playing games. Like, what doesn't make sense medically to, like, take it out, wake him up, and then put him back on? Like, what are we doing here? Are we taking it out or are we not taking it out? And they didn't entertain that option. If we would have pushed harder and said, no, we want to do this as a compromise, it could have happened, but it's not the direction we went. So it's interesting. They told us that we can't do it. We can't not do.
So you could have the best of both worlds. Like you could.
Well, why is it the best of both worlds?
Because A, he could have the opportunity to talk to his parents, blah, blah, his parents. I think it's more about the parents than him personally. I think it's a lot of the parents' guilt or whatever and wanting to see their son, which I completely understand. But also, like, why make his last days, like, so angry? And you don't know how he's going to react. Like, Chatzir Chadira, he could... Like, I don't know, like, something really worse could happen, and he could die then. So, I don't know. I think you should leave it in.
Oh, you're saying leave it in? No, not take it out, put it back.
I mean, obviously, if we could do that, but you said that's not an option. So, I would say leave it in. It's not worth it.
Just leave it in. I see. Because maybe, because right, because as you pointed out, should we make the decision based on what is better for his parents or what's better for him?
Right. Yeah.
Which?
Him.
Right.
He's the priority.
Right. He's the patient.
He's the one on his deathbed.
Right.
Like, if you had this conversation up till now and he's like, I hate my parents, I never want to talk to them, the least you can do is honor that.
Uh-huh. And by the way, if we take him off the respirator and try to put him back on, that's also not going to be so simple. Meaning,
right.
If you take him off and say, okay, we're putting you back on, what if he says, like, no, I don't want to go back on that thing? We're going to force him?
Yeah.
So that's another challenge with the option of taking him off and putting him back on. But, okay, good points. Yes.
But why should he be in pain if he minds if he's just going to die anyway?
He's not in pain, he's sedated.
Right, you're saying if he's going to die anyways, let him die sooner than later? Yeah, but the point is, yeah, I don't know that he's experiencing pain because he's totally sedated and he's gradually dying.
It's just more time and, like, money.
That's true, though. Yes, right. It's more time. It's just prolonging the inevitable. Good point.
There was no way to save him either way. Like,
it's a nuts. They had been talking about a liver transplant, but now at this point they said he was on a candidate for a liver transplant, so... Yeah, there doesn't seem to be any way to save his life. You could say, some people have said in the past, well, if you keep him alive longer, there's more chance for, like, a miracle. But I don't know if we can make decisions based on that.
Well, first of all, you're not supposed to rely on miracles.
Right.
And also, like, if he's unconscious for, like, you said 3 months, he's not really, you know, like, what life are you prolonging? He's not really, like, doing anything.
Yes.
You give him those
Good
3 days... He could actually, like, something could happen.
Right.
On one hand, he can get really angry at his parents, but he could also reconcile with them. He could, like...
Right. Right, good point.
Yeah.
Right. What's 3 months of just being in a coma versus 3 days of being alert?
But he really didn't want to see his parents. And,
right.
Like, he told, like, the one thing he said was,
yes.
I don't want to see my parents.
Right.
And it's just, like, unfair to him to be like, oh, we're waking you up so that your mom and dad can say bye to you. Like, then he's spending his last 3 days living a terrible, like, oh my gosh, I don't want to see my parents. Like, he's just having that mindset rather than maybe, like, spending 3 months, like, unconscious, but, like, not knowing that they're there and not,
right.
like, understanding that.
Good point. That's the challenge. Although I will say one thing that impressed me was as much as he told me how much he hates his parents, and I got the impression talking to him, like, these must be horrible people, then I did see that the second we called them, they were extremely nice and compassionate, and they flew out right away, and they just wanted to see him. Like, it did change my picture of them a little bit. Yeah.
You don't know what's going on at home, though.
Right,
they could be
yes.
very, like, upfront, very
for
nice
sure.
people, very caring people, but then I'm sure there's a reason he ran away.
Yes, good point. Good point. They might seem very nice, and none of us ever know what's going on behind closed doors.
I don't think people write in a will whether they want to be taken off flight support.
Well, yeah, so that's called an advance directive. There is something called an advance directive, which is a great thing to do, where you describe what your values are and what you would want. Unfortunately, most people don't have them, especially 20-year-olds who are living on the streets. That's the sad thing. By the way, we do have a committee at the hospital. I mean, just as you think about, like, the ethical scenarios, this is a very common issue that we're trying to decide for people. As you all know, I mean, another issue relevant for our neighborhood is we have a lot of people who do not have homes, right? We have people who are experiencing homelessness on the streets around here, and a lot of them end up in our hospital. And part of our job is to take care of them like any other patient. They deserve the dignity and respect that anyone deserves. But most people, when they make decisions, they have family telling us what they want. They have a will, an advance directive that describes for us. But these people, oftentimes they come in the hospital, we don't even know their names. And we have to decide what's best for them. It's a big challenge. And we have a special committee that we have to decide. But you're right. If someone describes what they want. By the way, there was someone, this is actually true, someone once who wanted, you can Google this, there was someone who so much did not want chest compressions. You know, we'll do this also a little bit in the hospital. They didn't want to be resuscitated if their heart stopped. Chest compressions are very violent and, you know, invasive. Obviously, they save our lives, so they're worthwhile. But for someone who's very sick or frail, so sometimes if people would have an advance directive, don't do this. I don't want it. There was a patient who came into the hospital who had, they were worried, what if they can't find my advance directive? It's just some document with my lawyer in my, you know, safe deposit box. So they had it tattooed on their chest. Do not resuscitate. Because, you know, when they do this, they have to rip off the patient's shirt and they start pounding on their chest. So they knew if they had it tattooed on their chest, then they won't do it. What do you think the doctors did? When the patient came in, they rip off their shirt, they're about to do it, and they see on their chest tattooed, do not resuscitate.
That's not a legal document.
Well, and by the way, on their tattoo, it said DNR real big. Under that, it said, do not resuscitate. Under that, they had a tattoo of their signature.
That's wild.
But you're right. Is it a legal document, though? Ask your father. Is it a legal document? I'm sorry. I'm sure others of you have lawyers for parents, but your father's a friend of mine. Right? Is it one thing to have a legal document with your signature on a piece of paper? Fine. Even on a computer, we e-sign. But is it a legal document to have a signature on your body with a tattoo?
I sure thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. How could you imagine? I mean, you're not there yet, but in a couple of years, can you imagine like a frat party or something one night where someone they do like a drinking game and they're like betting. Oh, if you lose this bet, we're gonna tattoo on your chest, you know, DNR, and you could see someone thinking that would be really funny, right? So you're right. So what do you think the doctors did? By the way, in that case, did they resuscitate or did they just let him die because he had it on his chest? He really wanted to obviously have it on his chest.
They don't know for sure.
They did.
I think they did it. As long as it's on a contract, they went to
the Yeah, they did it. They did it. And by the way, they did it and saved his life. And this happens a lot in the hospital. As you can imagine, that committee I just told you about where we make decisions for unhoused patients, we usually err on the side of saving their lives, right? If we don't know their name and anything about them and we have to make a decision like should we do the surgery or not, we usually err on the side of saving someone's life. You're going to be better off saving their life if that's the wrong choice than not saving their life if that's not what they wanted. So we usually err on the side of saving life. Listen to this case. I know we're still talking about something else. We're going to come back to it, but I'm curious what you think about this. You know Jehovah's Witness, right? That religion?
Mm-hmm.
What's like the most famous thing that they don't do? Anyone?
Blood transfusions.
Blood transfusions.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah. They do not take blood transfusions. Exactly. Do you know in the Torah where it says, it's just a few weeks, parshas ago, you can't eat blood? Mm-hmm. So we don't eat blood, right? But they translate it as being like you can't consume blood in any way. You can't, even if it's transfused into your veins. I mean, you could imagine someone saying like, I won't take pig parts. You know that people are now getting like pig kidney transplants.
Yeah.
So you can imagine some Jews saying like, oh, I don't believe in that. I mean, we do believe in that because it's to save a life. And also, you can't eat it. You can benefit from it. Anyways, Jehovah's Witness, don't take blood transfusions. So we had a patient once, also your age, so just trying to keep it relevant, a high school kid, was on a motorcycle, got in a horrible accident, and lost a lot of blood. But in the emergency room, they stabilized him. They said, okay, all he needs is a blood transfusion, and then he'll be fine. He'll have a few broken bones. That's it. They went to his parents to get consent for the procedures, and they said, no, we don't consent. You can't give him a blood transfusion. They said, what do you mean? It's so simple. We just put in an IV, we give him the blood, he wakes up, he's fine. They said, yeah, but it's against our religion. We can't do it. So the doctor was saying, but we have to do it, and we have to do it now, otherwise he dies. What do you think the parents said? I'm sorry, you can't. What do you do? You're the doctor. What do you do? Save his life against the parents' wishes, or
if he's still a minor, he can't make decisions for himself. Like, his parents are the ultimate deciders. So
right,
if
he's a minor.
He can't get blood. You're not supposed to go against the parents' wishes.
Okay, right. He's a minor. The parents said no.
Is there any situation where he could still be a minor and they could still do it? Because it's life or death. Isn't it the doctor's obligation to...
Right,
you
save life.
Right.
Yeah, you would think so. Okay, good.
But isn't it like if it's on like a religious basis, you aren't really allowed to contradict what they say?
Right. I mean, it is religion. And in fact, one of the things we did, I got involved just because they wanted chaplains involved because this is religious. One thing we said is let's call their pastor. One thing I know about Judaism is that, you know, even though there might be rules, if you call a rabbi, sometimes there's ways in certain situations that rules apply differently in different situations, and maybe there's some way that a pastor can guide us. Here's what you can do. You can't do it that way. You can do it that way. We called them, and he said, no, I know it's tragic, but no, we can't. So the doctors were like, what do we do?
Isn't there artificial blood? Is that
there
like
is.
Better?
There is artificial blood that can be used in certain procedures.
Okay.
So, for example, there's certain, like, cancer therapies I know that we have at our hospital that uses artificial blood. But in this emergency situation when they needed a lot of blood, it wasn't an option, unfortunately. So the doctor said, and in fact, we've had this case. I've had this twice. I was involved. Once it was the mother just gave birth, and she lost a lot of blood. But they said, you'll be fine. You'll be fine, but we just need a blood transfusion. And she said, I'm not allowed to take it. Jehovah's Witness. Her husband said, also, can't take it. Pastor said, no. And she died. She ended up dying with a newborn baby. In this case, it was different because the guy wasn't alert. We didn't hear him say it himself. I mean, his parents, you're right. His parents said, you can't take it. We never heard him say it, and it's his life.
This happened also on Grey's Anatomy where, like, this guy, he's like a biker, and he had a chain, though, that said Jehovah's Witness, but everyone around him didn't know this.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I don't remember what happens in the case, but I think that even though he's unconscious, if he's part of a religion, like, you can't go against what the religion's telling you. Like,
uh-huh.
You, even if it's like, oh, well, he is not awake enough to make that decision, like, it's what you believe in, and you wouldn't want to live a life because, like, with someone else's blood if that's not what your, like,
right,
mindset is.
Okay.
Yeah, but couldn't they just do it for him and then the sin will be on them? And then,
no,
right, it's like his fault, like, you made me eat the non-kosher food or whatever, I didn't eat it. Right.
Isn't, like, the craziest sin for them? Like, is that, like, the number one?
I don't know
don't
if
do
it's
that?
The worst. It's just very prominent. It's a big deal for them. But clearly, I don't think it's like the biggest thing in their whole religion, but it's a big deal. Like, they do not transgress that. So we decided, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Was there any way they could have woken him up just to get his consent really quick?
That would be great. If that was possible, that would be amazing. No, but that's the point. He had lost so much blood. He was in bad shape. So we decided, we didn't hear it from him himself. How could we let him die when he didn't say he wants to die? Even though his parents said, tragically, as much as they want him to live, obviously they're his parents, we said, you know what, we got to save his life. And so we did. We gave him the blood transfusion. He woke up. He found out we saved his life. And he was furious.
Yeah,
he felt that he was now impure. And he actually sued the hospital for, you've heard of wrongful death lawsuits?
Did he win?
He sued the hospital for wrongful life.
Oh my God.
Wrongful life lawsuit. I shouldn't be alive. I know in the last class, the last group I shared this with, they were like, okay, so just kill him. Say, okay, you don't want to be alive? Fine. We'll kill you. You think you want that? No, but obviously we can't kill him. But that's what we decided. We decided better to err on the side of saving life. And he sued us for wrongful life. Wrongful life. A lot of money.
Did he win?
Which is also weird because, like, if you don't want to be alive, what are you going to do with the money? Like, what do you need money for? But it was the punishment. It was the principle.
Wasn't he a minor, though? So anyways, he went against his parents' wishes. And
yes. Also, went against the parents' wishes
and, like, that,
to save his life.
But he's a minor, though, so he couldn't have made the decision anyways. Like,
well, he could have. There's something called maturing minor doctrine. A 16-year-old does have some autonomy.
Couldn't he get emancipated in the...
Well, okay, that's another issue, but that takes time. So anyways, this was a side point. All this was a side point. How did we even get to this side point? We were talking last about the wrongful... What was the case before that?
The parents
coming.
Oh, with the kid
into...
Yeah. Well, there was something else that led us to this. But anyways, the point is, there's something called...
3 days.
What?
3 days.
Yeah, but there's something else that made me think of this. What?
3 days or 3 months.
Yeah. Okay, but whatever. The point is, there's sometimes when people could be upset that they're alive, like that we saved their life against their wishes, and sometimes you can't just assume that prolonging life is what someone wants. Anyways, yeah.
Was there any possibility that he wakes, like, in that 3 months, that you said he sometimes would wake up?
Yeah.
Between that 3 months,
was there any way he would wake up? Well, he was intentionally sedated. We were sedating him. The hospital was sedating him.
So before he was fully inactive,
right. He wasn't sedated artificially. So we sedated him artificially, and now the parents had to make this decision. So they asked me, and we asked the rabbi. They asked me, but I felt like this is too big of a question for me to decide. So I was like, let me ask a much, much greater rabbi than myself.
Who's your rabbi?
Well, there's a lot of different rabbis I asked. The rabbi at that time happened, there was a rabbi in L.A. at that time who was visiting from Israel. His name was Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, who's considered one of the biggest medical ethics experts in the world. He was here, so I asked him what to do. And he said, halachically, you can't pull the plug. You can't extubate. You can't take him off the respirator. That makes him die sooner. You have to just, what we call shave valtase, just passively allow natural death, allow him to die, and that is what the halacha requires.
Wouldn't natural death not be forced, like,
well, you have to allow it to happen naturally. Meaning, you're right. Natural death would be just take him off the respirator and then let it happen. Let what happens, happens. But the problem is that our intervention is making it happen faster. By us taking off the respirator, we are doing something that then causes him to die faster. So that was what he felt. So that's what I told the family. You asked me, I asked the rabbi, and we said, we have to just let it happen slowly. We can't take him off the sedation. We can't hasten his death. So they said, okay, that's what the rabbi says. That's what we'll do. The next day, I was in my office and I got a call from the nurse. The family's asking if you come up right away to say vidui, say the end of life prayers with this patient. So I thought, that's strange. He's dying already? Like, ooh. I don't know what it meant, what she meant by that. So I came up right away. I walked in the room. I see the parents, and now also his sister had flown in, and she was there with him. Actually, she was in the bed with him, like kind of cuddling with him. And I noticed that he was not intubated anymore. He didn't have the respirator in his mouth anymore, even though we decided that we were keeping it in. And I also noticed on his vitals on the machine looked very low. His blood pressure was very low. And I see everyone's crying. They said, Rabbi, we need to say vidui. End of life prayers. That's the prayer we say before someone dies. It's like a confessional prayer and also the Shema, things like that. So we said it. We said the vidui. He wasn't alert at all at that point, I could see, but he was like struggling a little bit, struggling even to breathe. We said vidui. I stayed there with him for a little bit, and then he died. This was one day after we made the decision not to extubate.
Why was it out?
Why did they take it out?
Yeah, so I had all that those questions too. I was like so confused. So, but I didn't want to just say to them, like, just for my own curiosity. It was like I was there for them, trying to comfort them and be with them in this moment. I wasn't just going to say, like, what happened? So, but then the mother said to me, can I step out of the room with you? So I walked out. She says, did I kill my son? So I was like, what happened? So she says to me, last night, in the middle of the night, we decided, we're doing what the rabbi said, we're not going to extubate. But in the middle of the night, the resident came in and was talking to us and said, like, oh, we see the bag on the IV that has the sedation in it, it's running out. So we just need to refill the bag to keep him sedated. So the mom I said to the resident, wait, so you're saying if you just don't refill that bag right now, he'll wake up? And he said, yeah, if we don't refill this bag right now, in a few hours, he'll wake up. And she was like, oh, wow, so like this is our chance. And she also felt like maybe that's like passive because it's just like not refilling it. She was like, and they all started talking. This is like 2 a.m. Like, maybe this is our chance. We could see him and talk to him. Like, we could do it. And they knew that, by the way, if they waited a few weeks, his blood was getting, you know, toxic and like he was declining. Like, they couldn't do it then. It's like either now or never. So they told the resident, you know what? Don't refill the bag. Let him wake up. So he said, yeah, but if in that case, we have to extubate. We have to take out the endotracheal tube. We have to take him off the respirator because he's going to pull it out. So she said, okay, fine. Take it out. This was just their decision in the middle of the night when they're exhausted and having no sleep and just really wanting to see their son. So he took it out. He woke up in the morning. He saw them. They were right there in the room and he woke up. And he started crying. And he said, he didn't obviously know how critical the situation was, but he said, thank you so much for coming. Thank you for being here. They started crying. They said, you know, we love you. We're sorry for whatever we did to you. He said, no, I'm sorry for whatever I did to you. I love you. They totally, like, reconciled and, like, hugged each other and started, like, reminiscing about good old days and, like, laughing and just, like, catching up. And then over the course of the day, he got weaker and weaker and then died that same day. So now this is her question. Did I kill my son? What do you say? Did she kill him?
He was going to die.
I think so.
Yeah.
She made it happen sooner.
She did make
it
happen sooner.
I'm so happy they had a happy ending.
Right.
Like, Baruch Hashem, like, that was the best possible outcome in a way, like, for the relationship. But also, like, you can't deny the fact that you extubated your son. We just said that taking out the tube is going to make him die faster.
Did he
made him die faster.
Did he know what, like, the positive, like, the options?
No. He didn't know that it was like he had those two chances and here, what would you have done? Clearly, he seemed to appreciate.
And I think it's probably fine.
But she made the decision also, like, so overtired. Like, it wasn't the right mindset to have when she made that choice.
Right.
And I think that she should be more aware that, oh, if we don't put in more sedation and we take the tube out, like, I'm the one that gave these commands to do it. And it is sort of her responsibility for giving those, like...
Right. Right. So we only have 10 minutes left, so I'm not going to tell you what I said yet, because tomorrow we're going to look at more like the biological and the halakhic issues, but let's do one more case, so we only have time. I'm not going to tell you what I said, but obviously I didn't say to her in that moment, yeah, you killed your son. But it is a very difficult dilemma. Like you say, on the one hand, she did hasten his death. On the other hand, it turned out to be good in certain ways that she did it, because it created a really amazing reconciliation that they had. So it's a very hard, very difficult. So I'll tell you, we'll go into the halakhic issues tomorrow, but let's just do one more case in the 10 minutes we have left, just enough time to do that last case. And then we'll bring these both cases together tomorrow, and then next week, as I said, we'll actually go into the hospital and do these things that we're talking about. Here's the case. Remember every detail of this case, because again, every detail is relevant for the decision you're going to have to make. Here is a patient who's 86 years old. 86 years old, lives alone because his wife has already died, but his whole family... 4 children and lots of grandchildren all live in the neighborhood. And his whole thing in life is that he likes to garden. In fact, he has a garden in his backyard that he loves so much that he actually eats the food from his garden. Like, he makes salads from his garden. So he loves to garden, and he loves to go for walks at night to have dinner at each of his children and grandchildren's homes in the neighborhood. So again, 86-year-old man, lives alone, but his children and grandchildren all live in the neighborhood. He likes to go for walks, and he likes to garden. That's his life, okay? He's a very happy person, very healthy person. But unfortunately, he had a horrible infection. He got this infection, wasn't getting better. I tried some antibiotics, right? For infections, he's taking antibiotics, and wasn't getting better. In fact, he kept getting worse and worse, so he had to go to the emergency room. He's admitted to the hospital. They're trying antibiotics, and it's not working on this infection. Is there just one antibiotic that's just like one antibiotic for all infections? No, there's lots of different types of antibiotics. They call them different generations of antibiotics, more and more advanced. And in the hospital, one of the things we do is they take biopsies from patients. They'll take a little bit of his infection, take a little bit of his, you know, a sample from him, bring it to the lab, and they'll test different antibiotics on it until they get the right one, and then send it up to his room and give him the drug. So, but it was taking like days and days, and they're not getting the right antibiotic. He got somehow a very rare infection. And he was getting sicker and sicker. In fact, it got so bad that he's in the ICU. He's not alert anymore. He's now put on a respirator, on a ventilator, intubated. And unfortunately, his extremities became necrotic, which means his hands and his feet started to turn like black and dry and shriveled up, and like dying. And it was going up his fingers into his hands and up his toes into his feet into his legs and gradually spreading. So it was really bad. You see his body is like starting to deteriorate. Thankfully, though, as they started to see that process happening, in the lab, in the pathology lab, they got the right antibiotic. They got word back to the doctors, okay, we've now tested and we have an antibiotic that's going to work. We'll send it up. It takes another 3 or 4 days. You know, you take antibiotics, it takes a few days for it to kick in. But 3 or 4 days from now, we should have the infection under control. So the doctors told the family, okay, good news. Well, good news and bad news. Good news is we can finally treat the infection. It should just be 3 or 4 more days until he starts to actually respond to it and improve. Bad news is, anyone want to guess what the bad news is?
Amputated.
Exactly. This, what's happening to his hands and feet is only going to get worse for 3 or 4 more days. It's going to go up his arms, up his legs, until we finally respond to the antibiotic. In the meantime, that is not going to recover. Like, that's not something that just goes away. It's permanent. And it could get worse. So what has to happen as a result, some of you said it already,
amputate.
They'll have to amputate his arms and his legs. So basically, what this means is, we're going to give him the antibiotic, and he'll wake up in another week or two. When he wakes up at age 86... he's going to wake up all of a sudden, look around, and not have arms or legs. What should we do? Should we just go forward with amputation and antibiotics, save his life? Or say, you know what? No, just let him die at this point. Let it keep going. Let him die.
Just save his life.
He could get fake arms, fake legs.
Right, just prosthetics.
Yeah.
You can get, and you can do it, the rehab, and gradually.
Yeah.
Okay, there's that. Yes?
I don't think that's a life he'd want to live. You said he was really like gardening and being outside. If you don't have any arms or legs, I think you'd just be miserable.
But then if you get fake ones, you could learn how to use them.
He's 86.
Right, that's the challenge. At 86. Like, does he want to go through all the... Someone said they want to be OT in here for, right?
Yeah.
Does he want to go through all the OT, PT, like all the... At age 86. And if he wakes up, is he going to be very depressed? Maybe his whole life was being independent. And now all of a sudden he's going to... On the other hand, some of you are saying, like, no, save his life. Isn't that obvious? Like, I think the majority... Actually, let's raise hands. If you don't want to, you don't have to. But no judges, no judgment. Let's just see. Who would say, you know what? Amputate, save his life. You got to... It's just, at the end of the day, it's his life. Okay? Who would say, let him die? Okay, this is how it usually is. The vast majority say, save his life. Some say, don't. And I could see why you say both ways. But the majority usually do say, save his life. Yeah. Is it hastening his death by... Well, on the one hand, we're not actually killing him because we're just letting it happen. But, yeah, it does mean he will die much sooner, meaning he could still live many, many years. Even without hands and feet, he'll just have to learn how to live that way, but he could still live many years. He still has a lot of life ahead of him, and he'll be totally clear. He loved being with his grandchildren. He'll still be able to be with his grandchildren, just not in the same way. And the argument could be that sometimes our values change. Like, sometimes people have values... And they love one thing. Like, I remember when I was in high school, there was a guy on the football team that everyone knew he was going to be first round draft pick, and he was going to go to USC actually, and everyone knew he was going to go to NFL. And then he got a horrible injury that his football career was over. He ended up getting a scholarship to college with poetry because he got into poetry, which he was not into as a football player, but like he developed new interests in life. So values could change. Right, okay, a doctor's job is to save life. Yeah, and not to, yeah, okay.
You ask his children and his family.
Yes, okay, so obviously we have to ask the family. We ask the family, And the family was four. It was four sons. And the sons were split. However, they weren't split 50-50. That would actually be more difficult in some ways. They were split 3-1. Three, kind of like the ratio in this class of what we said. Three of them said, save his life. One of them said, don't save his life. Wow. Obviously, they all love him, but the one who said, don't save his life, said, I know him. He's going to be so depressed. He's gonna have to rely on us, first of all, and we're happy to help him. But he doesn't want to rely on us. He hates being a burden on us. That's why even when he comes for dinner at night, he brings the dinner that he grew in his own backyard because he doesn't want us to have to cook for him. The others said, like, yeah, but we have to save his life. Of course we're going to save his life. Here's the thing. You mentioned before advanced directives. He did have an advanced directive. It didn't give any details. It only gave us one thing. Who was his decision maker? It did list the decision maker was that one son because he was the oldest. And the oldest son oftentimes is chosen as the one to be the decision maker in these situations. In fact, many times in state law, it's the oldest son. So now it's three sons who all want to save his life versus their older brother who doesn't want to. And they called me, they called everyone they could, pressure him, pressure our older brother. His argument was, I know him the best. I've been alive the longest, like by a year. I know he won't want it. Also happened to be, interestingly, the three younger sons were all Orthodox. This one older son, not observant at all. So just interesting, because they were all saying, like, but the religion, but Judaism, you have to do it. And he said, I don't care.
Was the father Orthodox?
The father was very traditional. Hard to describe if it's Orthodox or not, but yeah, Shomer Shabbos. But the sons are more Orthodox than the father, though. So, So this became a big dilemma, obviously. And tomorrow we'll go into the whole, you know, halakhic issues. Should I tell you what we did now or save it?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
Usually I leave it as a cliffhanger, but
no,
fine. I won't leave it as a cliffhanger, but tomorrow we'll talk about more detail. We'll do more cases tomorrow, and I'll do the halakha and the medical aspects. But what we did was we tried to put pressure. Halakhically, I think the right thing to do would have been to amputate. I can understand the other argument, but I think halakhically the argument would be save life. Amputate, save his life, and he'll have to learn. In fact, what we did was, since the older son had decision-making capacity, the roles, we followed him. And they did not save his life. They did not give him antibiotics. They did not amputate. And he died. The patient died. The brothers did not invite the older brother to the funeral. And as far as I've heard, they haven't spoken to him since their father died because they're so angry. They blame him for their father's death. He feels like he did the right thing. I can tell you that I've had two other cases just like this since it happened. Both times they did amputate, and both times the patients were glad that they did, and they did fine, but you never know what would have happened. Tomorrow we'll talk more about this case and more cases like it.
Thank you.
Yeah.